Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It is Thursday, October 29. I'm your reader, Kathleen Jesperson. A brief look at the weather for today. Decreasing clouds and a bit windier. High in Cedar Rapids of 42 and a low of 25. Iowa City, high of 43 and a low of 26. Again, mostly sunny tomorrow. Cedar Rapids looking for a high of 47 and a low of 33. Our normal high for today should be 58 and a low of 38. The record high was set at 84 degrees in 1937, a record low of zero in 1925. We are in the waxing gibbous moon phase. Sunset tonight's at 6:06 p.m. and sunrise tomorrow at 7:37. We have 10 hours and 29 minutes of daylight today. Moving to the front page of the Gazette, Cedar Rapids makes progress in affordable housing. Ricky Osby, age 65, says he's never lived in a brand new home before. He's been blessed to live with his children in the Cedar Rapids area in recent months after moving out of Agin Apartments in the southwest quadrant of town. But in a few weeks, he'll move into a place of his own at 69 Miller Avenue Southwest, where 44 rental units at the new Anderson Green mixed-income housing development will open. "It means a lot to me," said Osby, who will move into a three-bedroom unit with his 15- and 11-year-old sons. "Seeing my family accomplish that, I feel really good that they are able to see me get us a place like that, so I'm happy." Ohio-based developer Woda Cooper Company's development brings more rental units for low-income residents into the market, while Cedar Rapids grapples with a low supply of affordable housing stock. City officials say the August 10 derecho has only exacerbated the need for affordable housing as some units sustained damage and residents have been displaced. Cedar Rapids Mayor Brad Hart said the city is committed to making sure that quality, affordable housing is available, especially after the devastating storm. "It's really important in Cedar Rapids we have a place like this," Hart said, "one that provides safety and stability to community members." The $8.8 million multifamily rental community offers 39 units for residents at or below 30%, 40%, or 60% of the area median income, and 5 units at market rate. 4 buildings offer a mix of 2- and 3-bedroom townhomes and apartments with options for 1, 2, or 3 bedrooms. A $9.4 million second phase of the development, expected to be complete by fall of 2021, will include another 48 units. Iowa Finance Authority housing tax credits are supporting the development for 10 years, with $729,750 allocated annually to the first phase and another $800,663 allocated annually for the second phase. This is an incredible property that has so many noteworthy elements: the convenient location, the beautiful and thoughtful project design, and the successful use of our tax credits, said Iowa Finance Authority Executive Director Debbie Durham. "But let me also say, these are highly competitive. You have been rewarded because this is your vision and the quality that you bring." Nick Surak, Woda Cooper's Senior Vice President of Development, said the waiting list for a unit at Anderson Green already is long enough to fill the second phase. The units boast a large open concept design, are accessible to individuals with disabilities, and have washers and dryers in each unit. There also is a community space with a fitness center and gathering area for residents, as well as a playground. There will be an on-site manager and monthly inspections of the units to keep up on housekeeping and maintenance, and to check in with residents, Surak said. Water and internet are included, and residents pay for gas and electric, but the units include energy-efficient appliances to help keep utility costs down. The three-bedroom apartments help fill a demand for affordable, larger units in this market, Surak said. According to February's Maxfield Research and Consulting Housing Analysis, the city's rental vacancy at the time was 2.2%. The study says demand for subsidized rental housing in Cedar Rapids metro area through 2025 calls for 450 new deep subsidy units and 751 shallow subsidy units. It'll take several years for the city to build additional affordable housing developments, but there's already another project in the works. Construction will begin in March of 2021 and is expected to wrap up by March 2023 on the Annex Group's $29.4 million development of 180 affordable units at Wiley Boulevard Southwest, an area hit hard by the derecho. City Councilmember Ashley Vanorney, who serves on the city's development committee and represents the district in which Anderson Green is located, said the spaces will fit the needs of larger families with spacious closets, plentiful external space, and secure entrances, to name a few features. She also said the security features and spaces that foster community gatherings show that the developer understands how communities work. As Cedar Rapids replenishes its housing stock, she said it will be important to make sure new units are high quality, and she thinks Anderson Green sets a standard for affordable housing in the city. "They look like things that I would want," Vanorney said of the amenities and quality of the units she toured on Wednesday. "And that's important to me because these are my constituents. So when I look at what I do want for people, I always want housing dignity as much as I want housing security. I don't want them to live in just any home or any space." Also on the front page, Project Mixing Housing and Farming advances, a housing concept that blends urban living with working farm, took a step forward Wednesday when Linn County supervisors said they want a local firm to serve as master developer of the site east of Cedar Rapids. Supervisors voted to authorize negotiations with the Hiawatha-based Amon Companies to act as master developer of Dow's Farm, a concept that took cues from other agri communities, including one underway near Des Moines. Linn County Planning and Development Director Les Beck said the selection team was impressed by the timeline Amon proposed during interviews. For the 251 residential unit project, they will be built on county-owned land. The tentative time frame that Amon put together had a 4 to 5 year build-out, Beck said. "We thought it was a fairly impressive time frame, and during the interview, they felt it was a realistic time frame." Dow's Farm, on the west side of Highway 13 and bordered by Mount Vernon Road, Dow's Road, and the Squaw Creek residential development, first was purchased by the county in 2016. The 179-acre farm property is one of two parcels purchased at the time, totaling 485 acres for $7.2 million. The other 306 acres was bought to expand Wanity Park, then called Squaw Creek Park. The division of Dow's Farm is to incorporate and protect the site's significant environmental features and respect its agricultural heritage, according to the county. Beck said half of the Dow's Farm land, or about 89 acres, will remain in open space managed by Linn County Conservation that will protect environmental resources along the creek. The last half of the space will be split between the farm operations and the residential community, which means only 25% of the entire property will be developed, Beck said. The space currently is being used as a derecho debris site. On Wednesday, the supervisors also agreed to extend a farm management agreement between Linn County and the Sustainable Iowa Land Trust to 2023, instead of the initial one-year contract previously offered. SILT, in capitals, S-I-L-T, which was launched in 2015, was the goal of permanently protecting Iowa land to grow nature-friendly table food, was picked in May to manage the working farm. It will have hired farmers work the land as independent entrepreneurs. The goal is to have some farming activity take place in 2021. "The farm and the community are really integral with each other," Beck said. "The success of the farm and the success of the community will depend on each other and build off each other." One idea, he said, is that a portion of homeowner association fees would go to the farm, and people who live there would get a basket of produce a week. Beck said the goal of the community is to provide various types of housing to offer individuals of many backgrounds a chance to be involved in the community. "We have had a lot of feedback," Beck said. "We've had some positive and pretty significant neighborhood opposition to it. One thing I think that has been missed by neighbors here is this is going to be a quality development. There are architectural designs, stormwater management guidelines, signage guidelines, and public art recommendations," he said. "At the same time, we are hoping the demographics are, quite frankly, more diverse than a typical suburban building." Beck said the community would provide housing options appropriate to different ages. "The idea is someone can find an opportunity to live here if they choose, regardless of what stage of life they are at," he said. "There are apartments proposed, condos, townhomes, cottage homes, single-family dwellings. There's even consideration for senior housing opportunities out here." Beck said there are currently no plans for assisted housing or assistance programs for low or moderate income individuals. "I'm not ruling it out, but right now there are no plans for it," Beck said. "I'm not defining what affordable housing is for this project." Across the country, there are at least dozens of agri-communities built around working farms, and more are in the development stage. Middlebrook, an agri-community being developed near Des Moines, is planning on a community with 1,500 units on over 700 acres, developer Kaylin Ludwig said. "Interest has been out of this world," she said. "A lot of our buyers are coming from Beaverdale and downtown Des Moines. A lot of leads come from out of state, too, from Chicago or Colorado." The Middlebrook project is expected to take 10 to 20 years to complete. Also on the front page this morning, this by Michaela Ram, at-risk groups likely to be at the top of the vaccine list. Once a vaccine against the novel coronavirus is available, healthcare workers and people in long-term care facilities are likely to be the first to receive it, local public health officials said. Beyond that, however, much is still unknown about the upcoming vaccine against COVID-19, including when it will arrive, how many doses will be required, and when it will be available to the rest of the public. The agency that oversees U.S. immunization practices may offer insights this week to the federal distribution plan, but for now, local public health officials who will be leading the effort here say they are preparing based on assumptions. "There's a lot we don't know," said Heather Meter, Linn County Public Health Clinical Supervisor. "It's hard to determine when a vaccine would be available to the public, since the timeline on when federal officials will approve it for use still is unknown. Dozens of vaccines currently are in development, including 11 that have reached the final stage of clinical trial, according to the New York Times Vaccine Tracker. New vaccines undergo rigorous review to ensure safety and effectiveness, and so far the first vaccines developed have worked as intended, with no serious side effects. Limited vaccines may be available this fall, but the COVID-19 vaccine supply is expected to increase substantially in 2021 and eventually be available for everyone who wants to receive it," Meter said. "Once it does trickle out more broadly, residents would be able to receive the vaccine at their doctor's office or their local pharmacy, and many commercial outlets also will receive federal allocations. There may be an associated price to visit the doctor's office, but Meter said there will be no cost to patients to receive the vaccine itself. Federal officials said last month they are hoping to offer the vaccine with no out-of-pocket costs. The University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics is among the local providers signed on through the state to administer a vaccine. As officials wait for official guidance, they have put together a team to begin developing a plan for vaccine receipt and distribution," UIHC spokeswoman Laura Shoemaker said. "One of the early steps we've taken is to order freezers for the vaccine, which have specific temperature storage requirements. Based on the vaccines in the later testing phases, residents would need two doses, taken 21 to 28 days apart. Different COVID-19 vaccines will not be interchangeable with one another," Meter noted. However, it's still unclear how long immunity from the COVID-19 vaccine will last and whether residents will need a booster shot each year. Local public health officials most likely will avoid mass immunization clinics, such as those during the H1N1 flu epidemic in 2009, because of social distancing concerns. However, some public health agencies could have the ability to plan a safe distribution to large groups. Recently, Johnson County Public Health and other local agencies were able to host a drive-through flu shot clinic. Participants were able to be contained in their vehicle and able to be vaccinated and drive off, said Sam Jarvis, Community Health Division Manager at Johnson County Public Health. Priority groups to receive the first batch of vaccine will be determined by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, the advisory group within the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The group is meeting this week and on Friday will discuss COVID-19 vaccine implementation according to its agenda. However, state and local public health agencies say it's safe to assume that healthcare workers, staff and residents at long-term care facilities and assisted living facilities, and other populations that would suffer severe consequence of illness without, are first on the list, Jarvis said. Jarvis said national agencies, including the advisory committee meeting this week, will more than likely offer detailed guidance on these priority groups. We'll continue to coordinate with the state health department and our local partners, but I imagine that much of the response will follow the guidance produced by our state and federal partners, he said. The Iowa Department of Public Health, which is lining up providers able to administer the vaccine, will allocate the vaccine to each county based on the estimated population of each county's priority groups, said Alex Carfrey, the department's emergency preparedness planner. From there, the local agencies will coordinate allocations to providers. Already, hundreds of providers across the state have signed on to administer the vaccine, according to Carfrey. As more vaccines become available, the priority groups will broaden, allowing more people to be eligible to receive it. UIHC officials noted that it won't be mandatory for its employees. As state and local public health agencies wait for word from federal officials in the coming weeks, Carfrey said county public health departments have been tasked to begin working with local providers to identify strategies that leverage partner capacity and resources to ensure widespread access to vaccine for the public. Moving to the Iowa Today page, Stony Point YMCA is for sale. This story is by Grace King. The Stony Point YMCA in Cedar Rapids is for sale as the YMCA of Cedar Rapids metro area struggles with financial challenges brought on by the coronavirus pandemic. The Stony Point Y, 300 Stony Point Road Southwest, has never had a membership base able to sustain a positive bottom line, said Bob Carlson, president and chief executive officer of the Y. It was listed for sale with Skogman Realty on Friday and will continue to offer services, including childcare, for the foreseeable future. We would love to explore sale options, including partnerships and collaborations, so we could possibly continue YMCA services in that location somehow in the future, Carlson said. That would be our dream. Carlson said he is unable to disclose the amount the YMCA is selling for, but noted several interested buyers will be touring the facility. The Stony Point Y was built in 1984 and underwent renovations in 2003. Members were alerted to the sale Friday in an email. Carlson said putting the location on the market was a tough decision for the board of directors, but a good economic decision for our organization. Our Metro Association is facing economic challenges that are unprecedented. We've looked at all of our programs, our operations, figured out where cash flow comes from, and unfortunately, Stony Point has been our branch that's had significant net revenue losses over many years, Carlson said. The YMCA of the Cedar Rapids metro area is struggling to give refunds for its Camp Wapsie summer programs, which were canceled because of the coronavirus. In July, the Mercy Health Plaza YMCA location closed to free up resources for other branches better sustained by membership fees. There are three other YMCA locations in the area, Helen G. Nassif, Marion, and the Marion Independent Fitness Center. A new regional YMCA facility is being built in Marion and is set to open in January. And in other Iowa Today news, Linn County sets a hearing on name change for roads. This story by Gage Miskeman. The Linn County Board of Supervisors has set the date and time for a public hearing discussing road name changes in the county. During their formal session Wednesday, the supervisors approved the public hearing to rename roads that use the word squaw in the name. The hearing is set for 11 a.m. November 23. The roads and names being considered to replace them are Squaw Creek Road to Wanatee Creek Road, Squaw Creek Circle to Wanatee Creek Circle, Squaw Lane to Wanatee Lane, Squaw Ridge Road between South 31st Street and Lakeside Road to South 22nd Street, Squaw Ridge Road between Lakeside Road and Cottage Grove Parkway to Lakeside Road, and Cottage Grove Parkway between Squaw Ridge Road and Highway 13 to Lakeside Road. The proposed name changes come after the Linn County Conservation Board retired the name of Squaw Creek Park, renaming it Wanatee Park. The park, roads, and the creek will be named after Jean Adeline Morgan Wanatee, a lifelong women's rights activist who was born in the Meskwaki settlement near Tama in 1910. The Linn County Board of Supervisors has asked the U.S. Geological Survey's Board of Geographic Names to rename the Squaw Creek to Wanatee Creek as well. A decision is expected to take several months to a year. The decision came from the input of many groups, including the Sac and Fox Tribe of the Mississippi of Iowa, Meskwaki Nation, the State Archaeologist, Iowa State Historical Society, Tallgrass Archaeology, and local governments in Linn County. Moving to the Insight page, the guest column today, Does My Vote Matter? This is submitted by Tom Christofiak, a writer and software engineer living in Fairfield and a founder of Climate Action Iowa. Only a bit more than half of eligible Americans vote in presidential elections. Almost every developed nation on Earth has a higher voter turnout. Nearly half of Americans, that is, leave it to others to decide the country's future. There are many reasons why. Some feel that there is no real difference between the parties. The differences between the parties are actually quite stark. Democrats and Republicans pursue extremely different outcomes for things like health care, economic well-being, the environment and the climate, and social fairness and equity, critical issues for all of us. Some say they are sick of politicians, or they've decided to give up on politics. Flawed as individual politicians may be, they are the ones who make the decisions that affect our lives. One can escape from participation in elections, letting others determine how things will turn out, but one cannot escape from having to live with the effects of an election's result. Some believe that politics is all about money, or that elections are won by the one with the biggest pile of cash. Money plays too great a role in elections, and moneyed interests have too much influence on politicians. But money is not the whole story, as billionaire Michael Bloomfield's expensive but dismal run for the Democratic nomination illustrated so well. More and more, small donors are making the difference in elections. Principled candidates who reject PAC and big corporate money and maintain independence after being elected are gaining more and more traction. Some think that the government is broken, stymied by ideological divisions, so that nothing will ever get done. As the American consensus shifts and more people begin to agree that our country and the world need to take certain kinds of bold actions to avert the challenges we face, the gridlock in Washington will lessen. At other crisis points in our history, great transformations were accomplished, driven by the will of the people. Some think that they are not well enough informed to make a decision. Social media and biased news sources make it hard to ferret out reliable information, but it is easy to learn the obvious distinctions between the parties and their candidates by looking at their platforms and their records and paying less attention to the interpretation of commentators. Voting not only decides which candidate will win, it also is a critical way to let those who are already in office know which issues you feel most important about. Politicians, by their nature, cannot ignore the voice of their constituents. It's been said that politicians have to listen, but only to those who vote. This is a particularly critical election, and everyone's vote matters. Again, that by Tom Christofiak, a writer and software engineer from Fairfield. Todd Dorman's column today, Election Day is Looming, Have a Drink. We're in the anxious homestretch toward Election Day, which ends the long 2020 campaign. It also marks the beginning of election litigation, recounts, and other unforeseen devious plot twists. And there's still a pandemic in full swing, although the Trump administration is no longer trying to contain it. Maybe you could use a belt. Here are some cocktails you could turn to in the final days. First, viral Surrenderac, a double Donald of COVID-19, rye risky, deadly, but downplayed. A Trump absinthe virus strategy. A sugar cube soaked in hydrochloroquine or any unproven quackery on hand. A dash of Fauci's bitter, ignored and contradicted. Rinse a glass with the absinthe until fully infected. Add crushed lives. Stir COVID riskily. Unproved quackery and bitter Fauci over ice as cold and lonely as a winter ahead. Strain the drink through a face mask and dramatically discard the mask on a balcony. Serve in a petri dish with a cruel twist of fate or a nose swab. The next one is called a screwover, a clear majority of popular vote vodka, an overrepresentation of Old Founders Electoral College elixir, a vast overpour of ruby red state juice or orange you glad, not all the votes count, a dash of disenfranchisement, gerrymandered, or suppressed. Combine the juice, elixir, and bitters in an antique colonial urn. Mix with the ashes of democracy. Force everyone to swallow it. Pour popular vote down the drain. The next one is poll watcher punch. An unnerving swig of swing state gin trending. A misleading gulp of national polls Kool-Aid sweetened. An unnerving pour of polling average never clear checked and checked again. Mix ingredients in a large bucket. Place next to your computer or other device. Using a long straw, continue drinking through Election Day and refresh often. The next one is Swing State Sling, a super pack of bombast gin televised incessantly, a super spread of post-rally quarantine, a squeeze of fresh lies fact-checked, a desperation of low-road liquor, cherry or racist, a tiresome canard of socialism soda, flat and stale, social media syrup concocted, shared, and duped, a cultural war wedge, and a Machiavellian cherry for garnish. Add the gin, quarantine, liquor, and syrup into a shaker filled with ice, cold outside cash. Strain to hide your outrage, contempt, and exhaustion. Add a garnish and drink until you no longer feel like screaming. And lastly, long election night iced tea. A media of exit polls vodka, misleading, a smattering of early returns rum, misread, a cacophony of talking heads tequila, mercifully muted, more tweets of angry orange guy liquor, hopefully deposed, and any other booze you've got. Mix enough tea to last weeks or months or until final results are finally litigated. Pour into a shatterproof cup, good for throwing at the TV. That's the 24-hour Dorman column. And we have one community letter today. Go back to journalism 101. This is signed by Donna Dufault Sims from Center Point. Dear Gazette, you have lost any morsel of integrity you may have had for neutrality in reporting political news. One example, on October 21 column by Ed Sullivan, Iowans no character counts and Trump has no good character. In the following statement, quote, the president lies all the time about his business record, his accomplishments in office, his associations with shady dudes, and much more. Perhaps most despicably, he lies about the infectious disease pandemic, ravaging our nation, potentially putting lives at unnecessary risk. End quote. Where is one lie listed that is based on fact? The broad stroke lies all the time is an example of judging Trump's character without basis in fact. Since my move back to Iowa last year, I have been unable to find one article that colors President Donald Trump in a good light. He is our president, show him the respect he deserves. Republicans had to show respect for the previous president for 8 long years or be called racists. It used to be that to be called a racist, one had to be proven to hate a minority. Now that word is slung around like snow in the wintertime. Furthermore, employ journalists, those who research and get to the truth. Once they unearth the truth, report it. Then it's the Gazette's responsibility to publish it. Again, that is signed by Donna Defoe Sims from Centerpoint. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Thursday, October 29th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now let's turn to the obituaries in today's paper. From other notices, in Aurora, James Timmish, age 53, died Tuesday, October 27th. The Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home in Olwine is assisting. From Claremont, Leanna Jane Hulbert, age 92, died Tuesday, October 27th. The Schutte Grau Funeral Home and the Cremation Service in Claremont. In Decorah, Elaine C. Meyer Munkel, age 94, died Wednesday, October 21st. The Fialstow Funeral Home in Decorah is in charge. And also in Decorah, Genevieve M. Rude, age 88, died Thursday, October 22nd. Again, the Fialstow Funeral Home, Decorah. From Iowa City, Cheryl Eakes, age 59, died Friday, October 23. The Lensing Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Iowa City is assisting. From Manchester, Marcia Ann Prusner, age 66, died Tuesday, October 27th. The Bonenkamp Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Manchester, is assisting. In Toddville, Charles, known as Roger Dunlap, age 68, died Wednesday, October 28th. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home, Cedar Rapids. And in Toronto, Michael D. Moeller, age 79, died Tuesday, October 27th. The Chapman Funeral Home in Clarence is assisting. Moving to the regular notices, from Cedar Rapids, John J. Bilson, age 69 of Cedar Rapids, died October 26th at the Dennis and Donna Oldorp Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. At John's request, there will be no services. The Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Cedar Rapids, is assisting the family. Also in Cedar Rapids, Michael, known as Mike L. Brown, age 74 of Cedar Rapids, passed away October 28th at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha following declining health. A visitation will be held from 11 a.m. to noon on Saturday, October 31st at the Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. A funeral service will be held at noon on Saturday at the funeral home. Burial will follow at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Again from Cedar Rapids, John Michael, known as Mike Sador, age 67, died Tuesday, October 20th at his home. The Tien Funeral Home and Cremation Service is serving the family. Also in Cedar Rapids, Ruth Ann Garib, age 63, passed away suddenly on Monday, October 26th at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. A visitation will be held from 9:30 to 12:30 Saturday, October 31st at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. A private service will be held at Cedar Memorial and a live stream of the service may be viewed. Contact Cedar Memorial for information. From Manchester, Curtis J. Chesmore, age 78, died on Sunday, October 25th at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Private funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, October 30th at First United Methodist Church in Independence with the Reverend Paul Evans officiating. The service will be live-streamed on the church's website and can be accessed at www.firstumcindee.com. Burial will be at Quasquetan Cemetery. Friends may call for visitation from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, October 29th at the White Funeral Home in Independence. The family will not be present. In Iowa City, Sheila Ann Croats, age 59, passed away October 13th. Sheila has been cremated and will be buried at Oakland Cemetery next to her family. A celebration of life will be scheduled for a later date. In Central City, Karen Marie Schmid, age 75, of Central City, passed away on Saturday, October 24. A memorial service will be held at 1 p.m. Friday, October 30th at St. Paul Lutheran in Marion. A visitation with family and friends will be from noon to 1 at the church. And from Whittier, Harold Thomas, known as Tom Holland, age 82, of Whittier, passed away on Tuesday, October 27th, at Living Center West in Cedar Rapids. In accordance with his wishes, cremation has taken place. A private family committal service will be held at Jordan's Grove Cemetery at a later date. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family. Moving to the sports page, high school sports, volleyball, Springville Superior in a sweep of Belle Plaine. This story is by Jeff Linder. No deep analysis required here. The Springville Orioles simply had more weapons. End of story. Seventh-ranked Springville displayed superior depth and swept Belle Plaine 25-21, 25-14, 25-16 in a Class 1A volleyball regional final last night at Benton Community High. "We're just an all-around team," Kennedy Brightfielder said. "We have everyone we need, and we need all of us." The Orioles, 26-9, were able to key on Belle Plaine's hitting duo of Alyssa Tegeler and Nicola Felipe. They dug up enough to get their own attack rolling, and sophomore setter Nia Howard ran it with precision. "We did have more weapons," Howard agreed, "and I used all of them. We were able to slow them down enough, and by the second set, it didn't seem they were hitting as hard." As a result, the Orioles returned to the state tournament for the second straight year and the fifth time in the last six. They'll face number 4, Gladbrook Rhinebeck, 32-2, in the first round match at 8 p.m. Tuesday at the Alliant Energy Powerhouse. "It's just like a dream," back row anchor Grace Mattis said. "If we keep playing like we have been, we can go pretty far." Give Belle Plaine credit. The Plainsmen were forced to sit out 3 weeks in September because of COVID-19 quarantine, then won 20 of 25 matches upon their return. But the Orioles were at a higher level Wednesday, posting a 43-25 advantage in kills. Springville's Lauren Wilson led all attackers with 13. Savannah Nealman added 11, and Brightfielder posted 10. Howard notched 5 kills to go with 33 assists. "When you've got 4 people in the front that can score, that makes a big difference," Howard said. Springville never was in crisis mode in any of the 3 sets. The Orioles held a 15-13 advantage in the opener before Brightfielder posted 3 kills and Nealman served 2 aces in a 7-point run to extend the margin. The Orioles were erratic for a short spell in Game 2, allowing the Plainsmen to tie it 11-11, then turned it on again with a 14-3 closing run. Springville led the final from the first serve until the final celebration. And in another volleyball story by Mike Condon, West Branch bows out in the regional loss to Wilton. Tristan Shawyer said she really didn't know what to expect in her first year as head coach. The West Branch volleyball coach obviously came up with a lot of answers, leading the Bears to last night's Class 2A regional final against number 2 Wilton. However, she and her players had no answer for Wilton's Kelsey Drake. The 5'10" junior pounded home 26 kills as the Beavers rolled to a 25-10, 25-20, 25-17 victory, earning the school's third straight state trip. Wilton will be the number 2 seed in the 2A state tournament. The Beavers will play at 12:30 p.m. next Tuesday against number 7 Van Meter, 19-3, in the quarterfinals at the Alliant Energy Powerhouse in Cedar Rapids. West Branch retires at 20-14. "When you get to this level, you are going to get everybody's best, and they are going to ball out," Shawyer said. She did that. Drake said she felt good coming into the match. "I came to hit," she said with a smile. "We've been working really hard in practice on staying aggressive, and it really clicked tonight." Wilton coach Brenda Grunder said that Drake gets on a roll. She is tough to defend. She just loves to swing, Grunder said. She has great hang time and a power swing. It is just a beautiful thing. Wilton scored 16 of the last 19 points to take game one. Shawyer said it would have been easy for her team to fold at that point. I'm honestly so proud of the way our girls fought. The girls battled, and Wilton is a phenomenal team. Game two was tied at 17-17, and it appeared the Bears might be able to even the match. Drake took care of that with three kills to help Wilton put the game away. Leading 15-13 in game three, the Beavers pulled away as Drake rattled off another string of kills. Grunder is convinced her team is in a good position heading to state. This team is so comfortable with each other, she said. I think they are very aware of their potential and are happy to have this opportunity. Moving to the living page today, eating in, diners weigh the ethics, risks, and responsibility of eating inside. Before dining out became a game of risk with real-life consequences, Mary Kay would pick a restaurant based on what she actually wanted to eat or what place had just opened in her neighborhood in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. Those days are gone. Her selection process is considerably more rigorous now, and it involves a checklist. What are the restaurant's COVID-19 protocols? How far are the tables spaced apart? On what block does the restaurant do business? Is there a lot of foot traffic? If the restaurant can't satisfy her minimum requirements, she won't patronize its patio. She doesn't even have a checklist for indoor dining, which resumed in New York City on September 30. For her, that option isn't on the table. To dine in or not to dine in, the considerations begin with the personal and quickly expand to public concerns. Worker welfare, lack of universal health care, restaurant survival, ventilation systems, government safety nets, questionable information sources, and more. These considerations are naturally influenced by daily news, which can fuel fears or create a greater sense of urgency. A lack of a new stimulus bill, time to help save restaurants. Dining out increases your risk of coronavirus infection, time to stay home and cook. There are ethical implications about eating at a restaurant and not eating at a restaurant. No matter what you do, you'll do harm. If you go eat in a restaurant, you'll endanger the health of other people. If you don't go eat in a restaurant, you'll endanger them in other ways, financially. It has real, serious consequences, since our government decided that a safety net is for suckers and losers. That's an abbreviation of an article that is from the Washington Post. And chew on this, Eastern Iowa restaurant wins the best breaded tenderloin title. This story's by Allison Gowans. Prairie Moon on Main in Prairiesburg won the 2020 Iowa's Best Breaded Pork Tenderloin Contest presented by the Iowa Pork Producers Association. Prairie Moon will receive $500, a plaque, and a large banner to display. In addition, the first 1,500 tenderloins sold are discounted $1. Courtesy of the Pork Association. Iowans take their tenderloin really seriously, so when we found out we ranked in the top 40, I think I cried. We were so excited, co-owner Amy Lacey said in a news release. And when the judges told us we were in the top 5, I shook. This is just crazy for us. Birdies, Burgers, and Brews at Hillcrest Golf and Country Club in Grettinger took second place. Runners-up included The Blind Pig in Cedar Rapids, Sasquatch Jack's Hideaway Barroom and Grill in Waverly, and Vent's Smokehouse and Pub in Westgate. The annual Great American Beer Festival in Denver, Colorado was virtual this year, but Iowa breweries still participated and took home accolades at the festival held October 16th and 17th. Pivo, or P-I-V-O, brewery in Kalmar, won a gold medal in the historical beer category for its Decora Nordic Groot. Single Speed Brewing in Waterloo also won gold in the Session Beer, or non-alcoholic beer category for Tip the Cow. PIVO Brewery also won a silver medal in the chocolate beer category for Old Balltown Bullet Bourbon Barrel Aged Salted Caramel Dark Chocolate Brownie Milk Stout. And Gazelig Brewing Company in Newton won a silver medal in rye beer category for Hugzilla. Big Grove Brewery in Iowa City won a bronze medal in German-style Marzen category for its Big Grove Oktoberfest. On the Business 380 page, this story by John Steppe for the Gazette, Johnson businesses eligible for up to $2 million in SBA loans. Johnson County businesses will have another month to apply for low-interest loans for up to $2 million through the U.S. Small Business Administration. Businesses in the county initially had eligibility for the economic injury disaster loans because of President Donald Trump's August 17 disaster declaration, with applications due May 20, 2021. Following U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue's October 20th designation of an agricultural disaster, that deadline shifted to June 21, 2021. The loans, which look to offset economic losses because of reduced revenues caused by the derecho, can last up to 30 years at a 3% interest rate for business and 2.75% interest rate for not-for-profits. Eligibility for these loans is based on the financial impact of the disaster only and not on any actual property damage, noted Tanya Garfield, director of SBA's Disaster Field Operations Center West, in a news release. Garfield said the loans are available for businesses either directly affected by the August 10 derecho or farmers and ranchers that have suffered agricultural production losses as a result of the storm. Ranchers and farmers may go through the Farm Service Agency, not the SBA. Linn County, Johnson County, and several other counties in eastern Iowa already are eligible for similar low-interest SBA loans for property damage because of the presidential declaration. Those applications are due on Monday. Applications may be found at disasterloanassistance.sba.gov. Also on the Business 380 page, Boeing is to cut 7,000 more jobs. This from the Bloomberg News. Boeing is deepening job cuts as the coronavirus pandemic and prolonged grounding of the 737 MAX jetliner squeeze the plane maker's finances. An additional 7,000 jobs are slated for elimination by the end of next year, bringing the total cuts made through retirement, attrition, and layoff to 30,000 people, Boeing said in an email Wednesday after reporting earnings. In all, the plane maker is cutting 19% of its pre-pandemic workforce after an unprecedented collapse in air travel and jetliner sales. We're aligning to this new reality by closely managing our liquidity and transforming our enterprise to be sharper, more resilient, and more sustainable for the long term, CEO Dave Calhoun said. Once a prodigious cash generator, Boeing now is carefully monitoring its liquidity and soaring debt while navigating the deep slump in air travel and working with regulators to lift the MAX's flying ban. Boeing has burned through about $22 billion in free cash since March 2019, when regulators grounded the company's best-selling jet after two fatal crashes. The Chicago-based company consumed about $5 billion in free cash during the third quarter, in line with analyst estimates, and about $620 million less than a quarter earlier, when the pandemic forced the company to temporarily shut down much of its manufacturing. Boeing didn't announce additional production cuts for its 787 and 737 MAX, defying analyst expectations, and also got a $459 million income tax boost. While losing money and burning through over $5 billion in 3 months is hardly good news, at least it wasn't worse than this, Robert Stollard, an analyst at Vertical Research Partners, said in a report. And closing out with the top weather story, after Zeta, what comes next? Zeta is the 27th named storm this season. The only season that has seen more storms was 2005, with 28. That included an unnamed postseason storm. The Atlantic hurricane season will last another month, ending November 30th, so it is likely that we will see a few more named storms before the season winds down. But given that we are already at Zeta, what comes next? It's a question meteorologists are hearing a lot lately, and the answer is simple. Zeta isn't the last letter of the Greek alphabet. In fact, it's far from it. There still are 18 Greek letters left to use. Next would be eta and then theta, both names that have never needed to be used before. And that's from meteorologist Jan Reihard. That does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. It's Thursday, October 29th. I've been your reader, Kathleen Jesperson. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
In the People's Pharmacy Health Headlines, the Food and Drug Administration has announced two drug recalls this week. Sandoz is pulling all of its prescription ranitidine capsules because testing detected a suspected carcinogen called NDMA. Health authorities in Canada, much of Europe, and Taiwan have already issued recalls for Zantac and generic ranitidine. The FDA has not yet asked other U.S. distributors to pull their ranitidine products. Ranitidine is an H2 antagonist used to treat ulcers and acid reflux. In addition, Torrent Pharmaceuticals is recalling multiple lots of the blood pressure drug Losartan. This action is related to detection of the impurity NMBA. This nitrosamine compound is also a probable human carcinogen. Torrent has now recalled more than 300 lots of blood pressure medicines during the past year.
Aspirin has been getting mixed reviews lately. Earlier this year, the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology said that low-dose aspirin should only be used by older people at high risk of strokes or heart attacks. Others, they said, would be more likely to be harmed. Now, though, researchers from Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center report that patients with head and neck cancer have a better chance of survival if they take low-dose aspirin while undergoing treatment. An additional 8% of patients taking the 81 milligram daily dose were still alive 5 years after treatment compared to those not taking aspirin. A different study at Roswell Park compared aspirin versus no aspirin among 164 patients being treated for early-stage non-small cell lung cancer. The patients got precision radiation therapy. 2 years after treatment, 57% of those taking low-dose aspirin were still alive, compared to 48% of those who did not take the drug. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has also recommended that obstetricians consider recommending low-dose aspirin to patients at risk of preeclampsia. This complication of pregnancy can be extremely serious for both mother and baby. Women taking low-dose aspirin are 24% less likely to develop preeclampsia.
Scientists suggest that the Puerto Rican culinary tradition of incorporating sofrito into many dishes might help explain a lower rate of breast cancer there. This condiment is made with onions, garlic, peppers, cilantro, and a related herb, rucao. Epidemiologists found that Puerto Rican women who ate lots of garlic and onions, including sofrito, were 67% less likely to get breast cancer than those who never ate sofrito. The total intake of onions and garlic was important, not only the use of sofrito. The researchers point out that onions and garlic are rich in flavanols and sulfur-containing compounds that have anti-cancer activity.
Despite lots of information about how to eat healthily, Americans are still getting too much of their energy from low-quality carbohydrates. Nutrition scientists drew this conclusion from analyzing nutrition health and examination survey data from 1999 to 2016. Although the American diet got a little better over that time frame, the change was modest. Only 9% of calories in a typical American diet come from whole fruits and whole grains. About 42% comes from highly refined grains, added sugar, and starchy vegetables such as potatoes. The estimated healthy eating index went from 55.7 to 57.7. Although this change is statistically significant, it leaves plenty of room for improvement.
Americans are often exhorted to walk on the sunny side or look for the silver lining. Can such a cheery attitude influence your health? A recent meta-analysis in JAMA Network Open suggests that optimistic individuals are less likely to suffer heart attacks, strokes, angina, and death from cardiovascular causes. The analysis included 15 studies with a total of more than 200,000 participants. A pessimistic attitude increased people's risk of cardiac problems. The authors suggest that health professionals might want to come up with interventions to reduce pessimism and promote optimism, especially in cardiac rehab programs. They express the hope that their study might stimulate research into the heart benefits of a sense of purpose or gratitude. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.